You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. This is our latest look at the Cleveland Indians. I'm joined by Jordan Bastian, and we are here at Tribe Fest. Actually, we're here at the prelude to Tribe Fest. We're recording this a little in advance here.
In a saloon. Show you.
Yeah, I don't want to get into how the sausage is made, but we're actually recording this a few days early because we had the opportunity to do it live, and that's a good thing. And we're at the, what is this called? The Wild Horse
Wild
Saloon.
Wild Eagle Saloon.
Wild Eagle Saloon.
Yes.
Well, it's a good place if you want to play some indoor bocce ball and catch up with Corey Kluber.
There you go.
We actually are fresh off the announcement. The All-Star Game coming to Cleveland in 2019. Hasn't been here since 1997. Pretty exciting thing for the Indians.
Yeah, and I think, you know, being at the press conference today with Commissioner Manfred and Indians owner Paul Dolan and everybody else who we spoke with, you know, I think the biggest takeaway here is, you know, this wasn't a decision that was made this year. I mean, this was a five-year process to lead up to this moment. A lot went into it. Other teams had bids, and the Major League Baseball was really impressed with the Indians' bids. That's why it's coming back to an American League city. And I think the renovations that they did over the last several years played a role in improving the ballpark and convincing Major League Baseball that, you know, this was a great place to showcase the event.
Yeah, it's great for the city of Cleveland as well. A lot of things have been happening downtown. The RNC. Hey, we got Carlos Carrasco playing ping pong by us. This is already an improving podcast. But all right, good for Cleveland, good for the Indians. But that's something to look forward to in 2019. For now, looking ahead to 2017, and there's been another new addition since we last spoke. JB, Austin Jackson comes aboard on a minor league deal. Obviously some outfield depth there, potential center field help.
Yeah, I think it's a good no-risk move coming into camp on a minor league deal, non-roster invited. Just adds that extra layer of depth and insurance. You know, as a right-handed hitter who can play center field and play the corners, you know, he could add some a complementary piece to Tyler Naquin and Lonnie Chisenhall if they're going to be used again, mostly against right-handed pitching. And then it also just adds another layer in the event that Michael Brantley hits any snags. You know, you now have an extra body, a guy with big league experience who could potentially just give you that extra layer of insurance.
Yeah, I think there's a great value in that because, losing Rajay Davis, that production they got from the outfield spot, I mean, he saved them in a lot of ways with the way the outfield shook out. So we'll see what Austin Jackson has left in the tank. But yeah, by and large, it seems like the Indians are still active in pursuing depth pieces. I'm sure the bullpen is still a priority here between now and spring training, or maybe even during spring training. There's so many arms out there, but it seems like more on the minor league side of things, minor league signings, bring some bodies to camp and see what shakes out.
Right. I mean, there could be another major league free agent reliever that they consider, but I think you're right. I think as we get to this point, you're looking more at guys that are falling into that minor league non-roster range, guys who maybe you even make a handshake agreement with for when they come into spring, knowing that they have a realistic shot at making the team, even if they are in camp as a non-roster invite. We've seen that plenty of times over the last couple years, especially in the bullpen for the Indians. So I think that will be a priority here coming up to spring, and also examining some utility options. You know, Michael Martinez isn't on the roster anymore. You know, is Yandy Diaz a consideration for a bench job, or can they target somebody from outside the organization for a utility-type role that could help make the roster even more versatile for manager Terry Francona? So I think those are going to be the continued priorities as we get closer to spring training.
The Austin Jackson signing, part of that is just some uncertainty in the outfield. In general, a lot of that revolves around Michael Brantley. What do they get from Michael Brantley this season? It was the question we had a year ago. It's the question we'll have here in 2017 as well. We know what the front office has said throughout the winter, but you had a chance to catch up with the Indians hitting coaches about Brantley. What do they see from him right now?
Yeah, well, Ty Van Berkelio hadn't seen him in person, but he had heard nothing but encouraging reports that he was really eager to get in the cage and take a look at his swing. Matt Quattaro, who's the assistant hitting coach, was in Cleveland at the mini camp here this week, and he got to see him in the cage and said he was really encouraged by what he saw. But again, you know, there's a lot of cautious optimism you know, going back to last year where it's going to take until he gets into games and into several games in a row for them to really get a realistic read on where he is health-wise. I think what is also encouraging at this point is when you compare to a year ago, he hadn't even started hitting off a tee yet at this point a year ago. It was after we were all in spring training, that's when he started the non-contact swings, the dry swings. So I think the fact that he's already hitting off a tee, I mean, that's a positive step. Soft toss could be coming soon. So he's a year ahead of where he was a year ago. I think that's the positive.
All right, well, now we have a special treat because we told you Carlos Carrasco was playing ping pong in the background earlier in the podcast, and now he's going to join.
Not very well.
The podcast. Very special guest. How's your ping pong game, by the way?
I'm terrible. I just went over there to try to have a little fun, but I'm terrible.
Obviously, baseball game is much stronger, and the way your season ended was disappointing for you, for the club, with the broken hand in September. How are things coming along as you progress from that injury?
You know what? Everything's coming good. So now I've been throwing 120, 150 now, and I'm so excited to get spring training and start, you know, get more with my teammates. And I can't wait to start the season. So I think we have unfinished business, and I think we are pretty strong right now with the adding Ernie Encarnacion, and we lose Napoli too, but it's part of the baseball. But pretty much all the guys in here, so we kind of talked a little bit. But we're all excited.
120, 150 miles per hour? No, feet.
Oh, feet.
I know, I'm kidding. Baseball aside, I mean, you've had a really busy offseason. You went to Cuba, Dominican Republic. I know your family was very active in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us a little bit more about some of the charity things you were doing this winter?
You know what? It's nothing to hide in Venezuela. Everyone knows what happened in Venezuela, so we don't have food. We don't have anything, medical supplies. So I've been sending medical supplies down there, food. We did a toy drive in December, so we sent it over there. So it's something that I love to do. You know, I always say this, but it's something that I can continue to do. So keeping me busy a little bit, even the off season. So I get to travel to Dominican Republic, Cuba, Venezuela. I don't know. Yeah, it's not good to go down there right now. So it made me feel good. So no, a lot of people helped me too. To get all this stuff to send it over there.
Carlos, obviously the big news here in Cleveland this offseason was the signing of Edwin Encarnacion, as you mentioned. You've been in this organization a long time. You're one of the longest tenured members of the club by this point. And you've seen, I mean, generally speaking, it's been more of the one-year deals with veteran-type guys. But to go out and make a big splash like that with one of the top, you know, free agent bats in the market is something out of their character. How surprised were you by that? How excited are you about that?
You know what? I was really excited. He got a lot of offers, and he made the decision coming here. And thanks God we got him. So every time when I face this, I don't have to face that guy anymore. So, but everyone is excited. Right away when we signed him, so I sent in a text to Chris, congratulations to bring him home. So I think every time when somebody say we're gonna face the Indians, so. We had the starting rotation, we had the bullpen, and adding Encarnacion, the position plays, everything's been great.
Carlos, last week, you know, there was some tough news in baseball. You were a teammate of Andy Martez, and you obviously knew Yordano Ventura from playing against him. Just what was it like to get that news, especially knowing Marte the way you did?
Man, we played together. I think we played together in 2009 and 10, but I get that noon and maybe 7:30 in the morning from my agent. Andy Martinez passed away, and a couple hours later we hear about Ventura. So it's something. It's painful because we play. We did a lot of stuff together with Ventura. Every time when we face Kansas City, he pitched. He's a great pitching, but you know what? I always say we need to take care of ourselves, what we're doing, and it's really sad day in baseball, man.
Carlos, what is this like for you guys? You're going to have a target on your back. You guys came up one game short, of course, in the World Series, but you are the American League champions. You have added on with Encarnacion. You are back. Danny's back in the rotation. You guys are going to be the team to beat in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know what? I think everyone feel excited about this team right now, and the organization, they did a big move to bring Encarnacion. I just talked to Denny Salazar when we practiced down there in Tampa, so he told me our team is going to be great now. So now every time when they say, okay, we're going to face the Cleveland Indians, so they're going to come in a little bit intimidated. Yeah, and it's a way different. I had different feeling to know Encarnacion is going to be there for us. No hand. So a lot of guys, pretty much all the guys they're bringing back, except Napoli.
And also, I mean, this last year you saw the Cavs won. You guys went to the World Series, and now the announcement comes that you guys are going to get the All-Star game in 2019. Just what's it mm-hmm. like to be a part of this organization right now in the city right now? Just all the things that have been happening.
Man, the city has been great. So as soon as the Cavs won the championship and everything on Twitter, Instagram, they went crazy. Now you guys, your turn. And it's something that that I said before, nobody believed us in the middle of the season with the ups and downs. And as soon as we passed to the postseason, they said the Blue Jays going to sweep out the Boston too. But you know what? We get to the seventh game. Mm-hmm. We lost that game, but I feel really happy with my teammate. I have so much respect for everyone, but including the three guys, Kluber, Tomlin, and Bauer, I have so much respect to them. So they carried the whole postseason to the last game.
All right, good stuff as always from Carlos Carrasco. I want to thank him for being a very special guest on our little dog and pony show, and we'll let him get back to his ping pong game. I also want to thank Jordan Bastian. This has been MLB.com Extras, Cleveland Indians edition.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Cashfrance. This is our latest look at the Chicago White Sox. I'm joined by Scott Merck and Merck. Sox Fest took place since we last spoke. You were there at the Chicago Hilton for all the festivities. Give me some takeaways from your Sox Fest experience.
Well, people are, you know, very excited about the rebuild. They're excited about the direction the team is headed. I think they want more. You know, that's kind of the rush you build when you get the seven prospects you got for Chris Sale and Adam Eaton. And arguably, as we've talked about many times, you know, you're giving up something great, so you should get something good in return. And Rick Hahn made that point this weekend. But, you know, that they embraced the younger players as if they had, you know, played for 10 years and competed for the Cy Young or MVP and pushed this team to a playoff berth. And as Michael Kopech kind of jokingly pointed out, you know, he hasn't even pitched in Double-A yet. So I think it's all about perspective coming out of this weekend. Perspective for the White Sox fans in that, you know, this rebuild is ongoing. So there may be another trade before they go to spring training. There may be another trade before the end of spring training. There may be nothing until the trade deadline. So you have to kind of keep it all intact. And then the same with the prospects. You know, it pushes you, it drives you, and you see that kind of reaction. But you have to understand that, you know, it's hard to get to the big leagues if you don't go to Double A first and get your work done there. So it's kind of, you know, the whole thing is basically a process and keep things in perspective.
It sounds like the reception for the prospects was kind of overpowering. I mean, we're in this age of, you know, prospect fantasizing, basically. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. But, I mean, these guys are stars already for the White Sox in some cases before even setting foot out of Double-A, let alone Triple-A.
Yeah, well, I've said this many times, and never has there been so much, let alone information, so much really good information. I mean, look at, you know, our company with Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis, for starters. So much just excellent in-depth information on prospects where, you know, you feel like, you know, these guys are stars. I mean, you know, people I think are already saving money to put down payments for the 2019-2020 playoffs for the White Sox, you know, because these guys are so highly touted. I mean, you know, the top 100 for the White Sox the last, I don't know, 6-7 years is kind of let's take a quick look before we go out to dinner and see who's number 78 and maybe who's number 95. And this week it was kind of appointment television, appointment, you know, online watching for White Sox fans because they had six in there, including the number two guy. And I believe Giolito was 13, 12 maybe. And then Kopech was one of the bigger risers. I think he was 16. So, you know, six guys in the system, four from trades and two from draft. So it should be interesting. But yeah, I mean, fans, as we've talked about before on the podcast and just in general, Anthony, I mean, White Sox fans were tired of the we're contending only if plan, you know, kind of the piecemealing things together, getting a guy who, if he has a good year, maybe then we can compete for the second wild card and sneak in and then let our pitching take over. So I think even if this team And right now, I honestly think, I don't think it's off base saying this team could win 73, 74 games. Although, as Rick Hahn pointed out, they weren't a 500 team last year, and you took Sale and Eaton off the team. So, you know, you go from there with that. But I think this team is not going to be your typical, at least at this point, complete rebuild 60-62-win team. But even in that sense, fans are just excited that there's a direction they're following.
Well, you mentioned fans saving up for 2019 playoff tickets. The free agent class that precedes 2019 is looking like it's going to be ridiculous in terms of the quality of players available. And I know you talked to Rick Hahn a little bit about the big picture plan and the plan to spend when the time is right, and that might be the time.
Yeah, he didn't exactly lay out the players they were going after, or if he did, I can't share that yet. No, I'm kidding. He didn't lay out it, but he did, you know, very stridently say that they are going to be willing to spend, and they understand that free agency can kind of complete that rebuild process. But he made a point of stressing that, you know, they're going to spend when the time is right. So, you know, if that means something comes available at the end of this year, it may not be the right time. It may, you know, even if it's a deal that could make a little bit of sense, it may not be the right time. But that you need that. I mean, you see that with the Cubs. You know, the Cubs don't win the World Series purely on the rebuild. They had John Lester, John Lackey, Jason Hayward, you know, on and on there. And you're seeing that with Houston, too. You know, Houston's adding some important veterans in the mix, too. And these are just two examples of teams that are, you know, that have had success, very great success going through this rebuild plan. So, you know, the Sox will do that. But, you know, I would not study the free agent players quite yet. I think it's a little bit of ways off, but it's in the picture, that's for sure. It's in the 3-4 year plan for the White Sox.
Hey, another big thing that came out of Sox Fest, it seems like Rick Renteria's ceviche preparation was a hit.
Rick Renteria can cook, apparently, or he claims it's the two main dishes that he made. He went to Juarez High School, which is in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, on last Wednesday to kind of the 25th, I guess it would have been, of January, kind of kick off Sox Fest activities, and he made queso fundido that day. And we talked to one of the girls who was in the culinary program, and she raved about it, said he didn't think it was his best. And she said, if that's not his best, she really wants to taste what his best is, because she loved it. And then he had the ceviche against a top chef, I believe his name is Carlos Gayan. And, you know, there was supposed to be a judging there. There was a chef from the Hilton, the chef from the Guaranteed Rate Ballpark, and Tyler Saladino, noted ceviche expert, Tyler Saladino. And, you know, it was kind of, I think it ended up being a draw. And even Rick Renteria said when he tasted the other ceviche that he lost. But I think they were both very good. From what Tyler did say, that, you know, he kind of mixed a little together, and he said it was the perfect mix, but they were both very good. And, you know, Rick, I mean, I think it just kind of speaks to Rick's personality. He is the right guy for this team right now. You know, I think they needed a change at that spot, and I think Robin Ventura realized they needed a change at that spot, you know, having left after his contract expired at the end. And not choosing to even, you know, broach a comeback for another year or two. Rick's got that energy, and Ricky Renteria has that energy, that focus, you know, wanting things done the right way, but having fun with it too. And he knows, you know, he knows what's ahead of him. He knows the prospects that are coming, the learning process. He was at the Instructional League. He was at the Fall League. He went to Dominican to see some of the younger players. He was there at the Hitters mini camp for all 3 days. So he's, you know, kind of got his hands in the mix right away and ready to go. And I think, you know, the Sox right now are extremely happy with the hire. And of course they knew him, you know, they knew him from the Cubs and they knew him as a bench coach for a year before he became manager.
Yeah. I don't want to put down Rick Renteria as a ceviche, but I don't think Tyler Saladino is the best, you know, most independent judge in that scenario. When you got the new skipper cooking for you, I think you want to aim to please there. So
exactly. There's talk next year of a grilled cheese cookout between myself and Rick Renteria. That's my specialty pretty much.
I can imagine. all right, Mark. Well, we did have some transaction news. The White Sox agreed with Peter Borges on a minor league deal, an invite to big league camp. What is, you know, what pushed them to show interest in Borges, and what are his chances of at least platooning in center field?
Well, I think not to play it down, but as you know, we've talked about, you can't speed ahead to 2019. You got to field rosters in 17 and 18, and you know, Charlie Tilson, I think, is their guy right now. They're looking at in center field. But, you know, everyone knows that he was one of the many first-year guys last year who, in one of their first, you know, I guess it was their first game pretty much, who suffered season-ending injuries. He, you know, he got a hit in his first at-bat at a game in Detroit, and then a couple innings later, chasing a Miguel Cabrera fly ball down in right field, blew his hamstring out. And so he, you know, he made the hitter's mini camp at full, you know, without restriction, I say, not at full strength, without restriction. And he told me that was one of his goals. And he still got some running benchmarks to hit as he continues the rehab. You know, it's a longer spring training because of the World Baseball Classic, so he has a chance. But Peter Borges, you know, gives you a veteran out there, a good defensive center fielder, a guy who can run a little bit, and maybe, you know, a platoon type of situation with Charlie Tilson, or could even be the guy if Charlie Tilson needs a little more time to get absolutely ready. So, yeah, I don't think Peter Borges, at least right now, is a guy who's a long-term situation for them, but certainly a guy who can help them now and a nice pickup for the White Sox.
All his rate stats pretty much ended up about where you'd expect him to be, but he did have one really hot stretch where he thought he might be a big trade candidate last summer. Didn't quite pan out that way, but we'll see what Borges has to offer in camp in 2017. Interested also, Merck, in Matt Davidson, who currently projects to be to get a lot of at-bats at the DH spot at the very least on this club. I know you had a chance to catch up with him, and it sounds like his injury adversity last year maybe was a blessing in disguise because it's led to some changes with his swing.
Yeah, you know, I talked to him a couple times this offseason, saw him back at the when he was working out and rehabbing during instructional league time. And, you know, he kind of rebuilt his swing, not this past season, but the one before that. Had a great spring training, hit over 400 with 5 homers and 9 RBIs, which is, you know, a significant total in the short amount of bats you have out there, even if it is in, you know, the Arizona air there. And then went to Charlotte and had a horrible first month, and he admitted started to get some of those same thoughts that plagued him kind of the first 2 years that he struggled in Charlotte. Then trusted his work, snapped out of it. Not really snapped out of it, battled back, had 2 good months, got called up. Played one game like Tilson, got hurt in that game. And from that point on, you know, just kind of did some work on his swing, some tinkering with his swing while he was rehabbing and enjoying his second son was born right around that time too. So enjoying his family time, he did some rehabbing. And it was more about getting the barrel through the zone and feeling like pulling more pitches that he wasn't. He does have good power to right center and right field, but he felt like there were some balls that he hit that were ended up being like flyouts to left. I'm sorry, to center or left center, that he could have pulled for home runs to left field. And you could see it, you know, I mean, I think I mentioned this on the last or one of the last podcasts that just looking for, you know, from my viewpoint, I thought he looked great in that hitter's mini camp. Now, again, it's BP. So who knows what that leads to, but it just seemed like a different swing, a different presence up there. And I think if he gets the, you know, wherever it is, whether it's third base, first base, DH, I think they're going to have some movable pieces on this team next year. If he gets 350 plate appearances, this might be a 2022 home run guy. And remember, he's just going to be 26 this year, and there's so much focus on the guys who are 20 and 21. 26 isn't exactly over the hill. It's not like, you know, he's too old, we got to trade him. You know, he can't be part of the rebuild. So this could be an important component to the team in the present and also moving forward.
All right. That's the latest word from Mr. Scott Merkin. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Chicago White Sox edition.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Detroit Tigers. I'm joined by Jason Beck. I thought it'd be fun to kind of reflect on your experience covering Jim Leland for so many years in Detroit. The MLB Network has a documentary airing this week about Leland's life and career in the game of ball. And I haven't seen it yet as we record this. It's actually airing Tuesday night, but I've seen some clips of it. It's really well done, the little bit I've seen. And obviously he's always one of those great baseball men, been through so many great experiences and you know, various stops along the way, Pittsburgh, Florida, Detroit, and just kind of an interesting guy in that he has this gruff exterior and, of course, is known to have his blow-ups, but he's also a player or a guy players love to play for, fiercely loyal, you know, like a father figure to so many ballplayers along the way. So just your experience being around him on a daily basis for so many years, what was that like for you?
Well, it generally was not boring, I can say that. You know, it's funny looking back on it a few years separated now. The more I go around and cover different teams, either, you know, covering, you know, my current team, the Tigers, or, you know, maybe jumping in on, you know, a session with a visiting team or maybe helping out during the playoffs, the more you realize how unique Leland was in his dealings with the media. And I know, you know, and I don't expect a whole lot of focus on that part in the MLB Network special, but for us, dealing with them on a day-in, day-out basis, it really was special because you just, on given days, you really didn't know what he was going to say. You didn't know sometimes what might set him off or what might spark a really good discussion. I know, you know, you jumped in on enough sessions over the years, you know, you experienced that too. There were days you'd go in and you knew you were going to have to ask something and you knew there was going to be a fight on your hands about it. And you knew there was a, pretty good chance he was going to blow his top. You know, some of it got into the press, some of it got on TV or radio, and some of it never did. But it was a unique relationship, and it was never boring. But I think in the end, Jim, more than a lot of current managers, had an appreciation for the job that you had to do as a reporter and the questions you had to ask, and that if you could take some of the grief, and there were days when there was really a whole lot of grief going on, that you generally had more interesting sessions with Leland than you could have with any other manager. I guess the one modern comparison would be Buck Showalter.
Yeah, those guys are few and far between. But even Buck Showalter, you don't get those days where you pop into his office and he's laying there on a couch on his underwear, you know.
Yeah, there was that part. And that's, you know, that's one thing I don't miss is that, you know, if you wanted to talk to Jim, you had to be there when the clubhouse opened, which is 3.5 hours before first pitch generally. So that meant for a 1 o'clock game, you'd be there at 9:30, and you didn't know for a day game after a night game which Jim you were going to get. There were days he'd be dressed, ready to go, and you could have a fascinating discussion on baseball stuff that you might not ever get from him during a session before a night game, because there'd be either too many people there or he would just be too distracted. And then there were other days where you'd walk in and you realize he just got up like 5 minutes earlier. Gosh, there was a one time he was literally in bed because the couch in his office at the time was, you know, was basically a fold out bed. He had the bed folded out. He was under the sheets. I don't think there were clothes on underneath those sheets. And he was conducting the session like there was nothing unusual about what was going on. Or that he fully realized there was something unusual. He just wanted to make you a little bit uncomfortable just because he wanted to rattle your cage a little bit. There's just stuff like that. The blow-ups with players, gosh, I could do like a half-hour podcast on this, realizing it now. But the blow-ups with players, generally you didn't see it. But the blow-ups you did see tend to be memorable. I remember being outside the clubhouse, the famous blow-up he had with his team, with his first Tigers team, when they basically took a bad loss when they had the chance to sweep Cleveland in the first month of his first season, and he just let them have it that you can't just give away games like that. And you could hear the shouting outside the doors. And we're talking about heavy metal doors and down the hallway from where the shouting actually was taking place. And you knew he was having it out with him. And then you go into the office, and I think his post-game session with us lasted like 45, 50 seconds. No questions. He just said, you know, this can't happen, and blah, 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 blah. It's just, I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the morning clubhouse open before a day game against Minnesota at the Metrodome. Tigers had lost an extra inning game the night before, and I'm there talking with Gerald Laird about, I can't remember if it was about the game before or if it was about some other topic, and Jim's still steaming about that loss. He comes in, yells at Laird about pitch selection between him and Brandon Lyon during that last extra inning during the fateful at-bat. And he chews it out, and Gerald's defending himself, as he had every right to. And they go at it, and I uncomfortably walk away and try to pretend like I'm doing something else, which, mind you, there's like maybe like two players in the clubhouse at that point, so there's nowhere else to go. So you basically just have to pretend you're ignoring the shouting that's going on in front of you. And, you know, they have it out, and Jim storms away, and, you know, we go back to talking, me and Gerald. And then, like, 5 minutes later, Jim comes back out of the office, and he's still mad. And he chews him out, and they get into it again because it was something else. He realized he wanted to yell at him about that he'd forgotten the first time. And, gosh, it's one of those things that when the Tigers named hired Gerald Laird to a minor league managerial position, that was the first thing I thought of. Because of the dealings he had with Jim, oh, my gosh. He took so much grief. Oh, man.
As did anybody who rubbed him the wrong way at the wrong time. But he was ultimately a loving man, you know, and he loved his players. And I still enjoy catching up with him. He's still around the ballpark quite a bit. So always good to have a moment with Jim Leland. And yeah, I think by the time most people hear this podcast, special will have aired on MLB Network. But check your listings. I'm sure they'll air it many times in the coming weeks. And it looks like a good one. So I knew you'd have some good stories, Beck. I think any of us who cross paths with Jimmy at some point have a good story. And I'm surprised you didn't mention when he got his cell phone that one spring and he got into FaceTime, because that was a major development in Jim Leland's
life.
Oh,
my gosh, that's right. Because his daughter was overseas doing one of those semester abroad things. Yeah. He was just stupefied by the fact that he could talk. I can't remember if it was on his iPhone or his iPad. But he could.
I believe
talk.
It was the phone, if I remember right.
It might have been. Okay. Yeah. And they had to set him up with the phone. This is somebody who resisted an iPhone for years and years. This was like either his last or next to last year managing. iPhone had been out for about 5 years at this point. And he was just dumbfounded by the fact. I could still imagine. I could still hear him saying it. Like, I can set this phone up, and I can not only talk on the phone to my daughter in Italy, but I can see her face. He couldn't get over it. And it was like later that spring, they had a spring training game, and there was a chance of rain. We were trying to figure out when the rain was supposed to hit. And he said he could check his phone, and he felt like he had the greatest thing since sliced bread, that he could check the weather forecast on his phone. He wryly remarked, "Well, I don't want to sophisticate you guys by doing this." Oh my gosh, we all just cracked up laughing. Oh man,
Jesus. The greatest thing since post toasties. That was his.
Yeah. Name. Oh gosh, yes, that was his favorite phrase. Man,
I remember now, Beck, when Johnny Peralta was suspended in the Biogenesis thing.
You know what I thought about 5 minutes ago when talking about the stuff that you knew. Something was going to set him off, but you knew you had to ask it. You were in on
it. We came in. Yeah, we had just talked to Dave Dombrowski. Dombrowski gave the organizational statement about Johnny Peralta's suspension. We go into Jim Leland's office. He says right off the bat, to his credit, he says right off the bat, I'm not answering any questions about Johnny Peralta. Dave addressed that. And sure enough, it had to be first or second question. I think it was a second question, because I do think we had a minute or so with him. If I remember right, it was like 1 minute and 31 seconds.
One of us had like a leadoff question and tried to kind of warm him up,
right,
gauge his mood. And
right, and
it was
had
right from there, the Peralta's
name. And,
oh, gosh.
And he said, that's it. Interview's over. Kicked us all out of his office. And that was the end. But he was true to his word. And I'm also remembering it must have been, this would have been 2007, but because I think I was doing a feature on the 1997 World Series and wanted to ask him about that. So it must have been 10 years out. But it was the quintessential Jim Leland experience, because there he was laying on the couch in his underwear, smoking a Marlboro, and talking about the 97 World Series. I always remember that as a particularly fun conversation. So
forget the time I got into it with him. And it ended up making a radio that day where
I remember that.
Brandon Inge was coming back from the disabled list. They just activated Inge. And Donnie Kelly had covered third base pretty well for him in the meantime. And I asked Jim what he saw as the role for Don Kelly going forward. And you could tell he was waiting for that question. And that just set him off. And he goes in this tirade, "Well, what do you want me to do with Don Kelly? Huh? No, you're asking me. Tell me, what do you want me to do with Donnie Kelly?" And he just went off on that for like 2 minutes. And I'm saying, Jim, I'm just trying to engage this. I'm not trying to spark any. And it ends up on the radio. And, oh, man. And, like, it's just an awkward session from there on out. And about 10 minutes later, we're in, like, the players' portion of the clubhouse. And Jim sees me. And he walks up and says, "Oh, stay right there. I want to introduce you to somebody." He walks the other end of the clubhouse. Grabs Donnie Kelly, drags Donnie Kelly over to me. "Hey, I want to introduce you to Donnie Kelly." Just joking around with me. And Donnie's got this look on his face like, what on earth is going on? And it was his way of like trying to knock down the tension. But it was hilarious. And I had to bust out laughing after he did it. And it's just, oh, man. But that was Jim. That was like, all this stuff is like classic Jim.
And none of this stuff will be in the documentary, unfortunately. They should have interviewed you, Beck. You should have been the star of this thing. You have some great stories. I knew you would.
Oh, man.
So, we forego the usual news and notes. We'll get to that next week. There's not much going on with the Tigers anyway.
Caravan stuff, spring training stuff. We'll get to it next week.
We'll get to it next week. All right. Good stuff, as always, from Jason Beck. We'll catch up on all things Tigers next week. Want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in and indulging in our Jimmy Leland stories. This has been MLB.com Extras, Detroit Tigers edition.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Kansas City Royals. I'm joined by Jeffrey Flanagan. Jeffrey, last week we dove deep into the life and career of Yordano Ventura. His untimely death it really shook up the Royals, shook up their fan base, and it's still a lot to process, but there was some communal grieving going on last week. We saw the images of Royals players in the Dominican Republic, you know, holding his casket, very, very touching images there. And of course, there was a memorial service in Kansas City as well. You got to attend the Kansas City service. Just what were some of your takeaways from being at that event?
Yeah, it was really a moving ceremony, a private ceremony just for the players and members of the organization. I think a little quick crowd count was about 300 people packed into this ballroom in downtown Kansas City, and very well done. A lot of speakers, you know, players, Danny Duffy, Eric Hosmer, just about every member of the front office who touched Yordano's life spoke. And of course, Dave Island, Ned Yost. There were a lot of tears, a lot of some humorous stories too, because Yordano certainly was a man who could make people laugh too by the way he dressed sometimes and just his stubbornness and all that. So it was a celebration of life, and that's certainly what it was. And it was coupled with FanFest last weekend, which certainly took on a different tone from previous years, where it's all optimistic and, you know, thinking about spring training, which is less than 2 weeks away. And it sort of had a somber tone to that, too. But I also I saw some healing, too, which, you know, obviously is one of the stages of grieving. You get to that point. And as the weekend wore on, you know, I saw a lot of tears being replaced by smiles and, you know, just trying to remember, you know, the good times with Yordano. And I think as a city, as an organization, I do see some healing as they move forward. And now we've got to get back into the baseball decisions.
Yeah, they'll be healing together. It'll be a process throughout spring training, I'm sure throughout the season. But the good news is spring training is right around the corner, and these guys will be back together to grieve together and to plan together and to move on together. You know, one question that's come up is how do they fill that void of Yordano Ventura's rotation spot? It's obviously a huge hole. It sounds like Dayton Moore suggests that the first inclination is to do so internally. Who are some of the candidates internally who might step into that rotation spot?
Well, I think the number one candidate is going to be Chris Young, who's coming off a pretty dreadful season. But, you know, Dayton remembers the season before that when he called Chris Young the MVP. And they've talked many, many times about Chris having a full off season, getting into his routine, his workout routine, all the things he does to prepare for a season. So they're expecting him to bounce back. And then you're going to need some young guys. You know, Dayton talked to me about, some of these young guys stepping up. And, you know, first and foremost, we talk about this guy every single year, Kyle Zimmer. You know, he's the guy who, you know, for years has had the best stuff in the organization but just can't stay healthy. He had the thoracic outlet syndrome surgery last year. He's fully recovered from that. He expects to compete for a job in spring training. The Royals would really love for him to step up and possibly grab a final spot in the rotation or at least be a bullpen guy to start out with. They've been hoping that for many years, so maybe this is the year finally for Kyle. And then maybe another candidate could be Matt Strom, who, you know, I've talked to you about many times, being targeted for the bullpen because they've lost some bullpen guys. They really need a shutdown guy in the bullpen, and he was that last year. But obviously circumstances have changed, and you know, I think he'll get a good look. He's been training in the offseason. I talked to him at FanFest to be a starter, so it'll be easier to transition from a starter to a reliever in terms of your offseason workout. So I think he'll compete for a job, too. And then there's always a surprise or two in spring training. Ned Yost talked about that, too. So we'll wait to see that. I don't think there's much on the free agent market right now. They've been linked to Jason Hamill, but I don't think that's going to be a price fit for them. They weren't really thrilled about the free agent market when the offseason began, and I think they're less than thrilled now, too, as it's thinned out. So, and, of course, there's always an opportunity to maybe make a trade, too. That's a possibility during spring. But Dayton seemed pretty confident when I talked to him that he'll be able to somehow fill that position. But you're right, it's a pretty big hole to fill.
What's the status with Mike Minor? He was signed about a year ago, this time, a two-year deal. And I know the hope there was, you know, he could be healthy and eventually contribute within the span of that contract. But this guy hasn't pitched in the big league since 2014.
Yeah, he went through another tough season last year, had several setbacks. And they're talking more about him as a bullpen guy than a starter right now. Of course, that could change throughout the season. But right now, if he's healthy going into spring training, they would certainly like him to step up and be a bullpen addition.
All right. Well, a spot of a little more certainty now is designated hitter. We've heard word that the Royals and Brandon Moss have agreed to a two-year deal. This is a guy who's for the Royal market, you know, evolved, and that game of musical chairs, as Dayton Moore likes to put it. It really worked out in team's favor, where there's just more bats than spots available. So here's a guy who, you know, price point made sense for the Royals, and obviously they had some at-bats to give up at the DH spot.
Yeah, it deepens their lineup. You know, he's a guy who hit 28 home runs last year. I think there are some concerns, though. You know, he hit 225 overall, had a horrible September last year. It was doing pretty good up until September and then just, you know, fell off the table. But he's always had good numbers at Kauffman Stadium. In 17 games there, he's hit over 300 and hit three homers. Of course, hit two homers in that wild card game. And for some reason, he's just sees the ball very well there. And he'll step right into the DH role. I don't know if he'll be a full-time DH. His numbers against lefties are a little bit hideous. But they certainly have a lot of right-handed options with Chester Cuthbert, Paul Orlando, and, you know, maybe Soler gets a taste at DH too. Sal Perez maybe gets a day off. So I think it's not going to be the floating DH, the plan that they've talked about all offseason, but it'll still be kind of a platoon, I think. But Moss will give them some great at-bats against right-handed pitching, which he can dominate.
Yeah, absolutely. It just seems like, in general, the Royals are going more to a power mindset in their lineup and probably out of lack of better options. I mean, speed is a hard thing to acquire in this game. You know, they used to have a lineup that was more oriented around speed than power, of course, when they first reached the playoffs in 2014, and it seems like maybe kind of going the other way. You know, you lose a Jerrod Dyson in a trade. You sign Moss, you trade for Jorge Soler. We might see a little more boom from the Royals' bats this season.
Yeah, and we've talked a little bit about that narrative before, that the Royals are kind of changing from this, you know, all-speed, all-defense team. But I will argue that, you know, Moss is eventually replacing Kendrys Morales, who wasn't exactly a speed demon either. And Jorge Soler is really a pretty good athlete overall. He's just not, you know, refined defensively and maybe not a great base dealer. But, you know, as Dayton and his staff have pointed out several times, is this team's pretty knee-deep in speed. I mean, you still have Billy Burns, you have Terrence Gore, you have Paulo Orlando. It's not like they're suddenly going to get slow out there. You know, Whit Merrifield, another guy who could, you know, grab the second base spot, and he's got a lot of speed too. So I think you're still going to see a very active, athletic team, and they may have a little bit more pop with Soler in the outfield, but they'll probably have about the same pop they will have had at DH the last couple of years. Maybe not as much as Kendrys, because Kendrys can really, you know, hit from both sides of the plate, but I don't think it's going to be dramatically changed in terms of an all-power lineup suddenly.
All right, there you have it, the latest from Jeffrey Flanagan. I want to thank him for joining us, as he does each and every week. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Kansas City Royals edition. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Minnesota Twins. I'm joined by Rhett Bollinger. And, Rhett, you were at Twins Fest since we last spoke. They had about 13,000 to 14,000 people there at Target Field for that event. What were your takeaways from that event?
That was a really cool event. Obviously, as you said, a lot of people there, 13,000 to 14,000 people. Last year, a little bit more, obviously, coming off a better season. This year, coming off 103 losses, a little bit more of a wait-and-see approach from some Twins fans. But at the same time, you know, it was pretty crowded throughout the weekend, especially on Sunday. It's always a fun event to see all the players there. It's impressive. I think the Twins had nearly 80 players, former, current, and even future ones as prospects at this event to sign autographs, do Q&As with the fans. Obviously, there's a big old, kind of a card trading show, I guess you could call it, memorabilia downstairs. There's so much to it. It's always fun to be around. And it kind of gets you ready for the start of the season there. I think the players are always happy to be able to kind of meet the fans and kind of get energized for spring training. And for me, it's great because I get a chance to kind of interview a lot of the players and kind of get a feel for how they're doing this offseason a couple weeks before they go to spring training.
It sounds like next year they're going to have to navigate around the Super Bowl.
Exactly, yeah. They're kind of figuring that out. I think the big thing right now is they might have to move it up a week just because the Target Field might be used as a venue for some of the Super Bowl events. So they're not really sure yet. And then after that, maybe even 2019, a year after, the Twins might even move the event to U.S. Bank Stadium where the Vikings play just because it's a bigger facility. They used to use the Metrodome, but had to move when it was torn down. Next year it'll be interesting to see how they kind of structure Twins fights on the Super Bowl, and then the year after that, we'll see if they move on over to the Vikings Stadium.
All right. Well, until then, there's still a 2017 season to play, of course, and the Twins, like many teams, are still, you know, peering into this free agent market that still has a lot of names available, a lot of depth bullpen arms and some bats still hovering out there. But, Rhett, I want to ask you about, you know, there's been some rumors about the Twins' interest in bringing back Justin Morneau. What is the level of that interest?
I don't think it's too high. I think the Twins checked in on Justin Morneau. I'm talking to some people. Morneau, it makes some sense in terms of leadership. He's a great leader. He's been part of this franchise for a very long time. But the hardest thing is just trying to find the at-bats. He's a first baseman / DH. The Twins have Joe Mauer at first base. You have Byung-ho Park and Kenny Vargas, two intriguing bats to be DHs as well. Morneau's coming off, a decent year with the White Sox in the time that he played there down the stretch after coming off of his injury. Would be a great leader. I just don't think they're going to find enough at bats for him. I'm sure he's probably going to be kind of looking elsewhere right now at this point. I talked to Michael Kadir. He did say that Morneau is interested in playing next year for sure. I just don't think it's a great fit with the Twins, unless he's okay being more of a bench player. But it's hard to kind of be a bench player and a leader at the same time. But at the same time, he's definitely a great player in the history of the Twins. I just don't think it really makes much sense right now at this point.
Yeah, I have to agree, Rhett. I mean, we've heard these rumors about Morneau and Mike Napoli, and I just don't see how the Twins are a team that fits in that wheelhouse, both from a competitive timetable standpoint and as we mentioned, just the sheer number of at-bats to offer. But you mentioned, Kadir's input. It certainly seems like they value the input of their former players, guys like Kadir and Torii Hunter. LaTroy Hawkins, guys who still have a voice in this organization.
Yeah, they really do. It wasn't one of those moves where it's kind of, it's like you get these guys in ceremonial roles that you added to the front office, don't really have much say or anything to do. But they're being utilized. I mean, all three of those guys have been called upon several times this offseason in terms of, evaluating free agents, especially when it comes to, personality, too. You can kind of call Kadir, LaTroy, or Torii and say, hey, do you know this guy, the free agent? What do you know about his leadership skills? What do you know about his people skills? Because the front office is pretty good about, obviously, being able to figure out if this guy can play in terms of, ability. But I think some of it's kind of the mental side of it and the baseball side of it. They kind of want to have these guys give some input. And they're going to have a lot of input in spring training, too. They're going to be there. I think all three of them will be down there for two different stints each, not only to instruct, but also to evaluate as well and kind of offer their opinions to the coaching staff and to the management of guys that could make this team. So they definitely have a real role on this franchise. Which is, a good thing because, like they said, they're big about collaboration. And, sometimes these new front offices with these, advanced stats kind of get lumped into these, kind of advanced stats. They don't care about scouting. They don't care about, what former players say or the kind of, old school stats. But clearly this front office is doing their best to kind of merge everything they possibly can together to make the best decision possible.
Yeah, and the Twins are searching for that kind of veteran leadership that those guys once provided. So we'll see if anything else happens on the free agent front, and we can talk about the pitching in a second, but kind of building off that conversation about the former players, I saw where Torii Hunter had some input about Byron Buxton, and he really believes this kid turned a corner last September. And, Rhett, sometimes September and April are probably baseball's two strangest months in terms of, how do you evaluate what you're seeing? It's hard to trust your eyes sometimes. I think any one-month sample is dangerous, but especially those 2 months. But Buxton really did look good last September. It was really encouraging to see after all the ups and downs and literal ups and downs from the minor leagues back to the big leagues. What are your thoughts on Buxton and that idea of him having really turned the corner in his career?
I mean, it sure seems like it. I mean, that September really was impressive. But like you said, 1 month is hard to base it off of 1 month. Even kind of going back to Aaron Hicks, he had a great, I think it was the month of July a couple of years ago. Everyone thought he broke out, and the Twins ended up trading him after that season at the Yankees. And I think the Yankees thought, okay, we got this guy Hicks who figured it out. And sure enough, it was just that 1 good month, and last year he struggled with the Yankees too. So you never know. But at the same time, the signs were so good. You know, we know that he can play defense. We know he can run. The hit tool is kind of the last thing to come around. And sure enough, it wasn't just a hit tool, it was a power tool too. What, he had 9 home runs in that last month of September. I don't think we're going to expect that as much going forward, but he does have some power. He's definitely a strong guy, a very wiry. I think Hunter is a guy who's been around baseball forever. And when he thinks that, you know, he's kind of seeing those signs that Buxton's kind of turning that corner, you tend to believe him because, I mean, he's definitely the closest guy to Buxton in baseball. I mean, he kind of is like a father figure to Buxton in some ways. They text and call a lot. And I think the big thing for him was, I think when Byron got called up that last time in September, Torrey just called him and said, hey, like, look, this is, you know, this is your last chance this season at least to make an impact, but don't, you know, don't sweat it. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Don't think too much. Don't think about your mechanics, the leg kick, this and that. Just go out there and play. Like, this guy was an everyone overall prospect. Just, you know, whatever got him in the major leagues is clearly working in the minor leagues. And I think some of it was just the pressure of being the number one pick. There's so much going on in his head. So many people telling him what to do, and, you know, so many voices telling him this and that and mechanics and this. And I think it was Torrey to tell him, hey, you know what, September, things are out of the race. Go out there and have some fun, play, kind of play loose and be yourself. And sure enough, that's what he did. And I kind of think he said just mentally he was in a much better place. And I think if he can kind of carry that over and keep that confidence into this year, it would be huge for this team. Because as we know, this team, pretty much the phase of this team kind of rests in the hands of the young guys like Buxton and Miguel Sano and Max Kepler and Jorge Polanco and Jose Barrios. I mean, a lot of this team is built on young talent that has to take a step forward this year, because last year it didn't happen and we saw them lose 103 games. And if it doesn't happen again this year, it's going to be another long season. But if Buxton can be that guy and be a leadoff hitter and be that elite prospect that everyone thought he could be, he'd definitely be a huge spark plug for this team.
How about Jason Castro, Rhett? We know, you know, he's been the only big-ticket acquisition for the Twins this offseason. You had a chance to catch up with him at Twins Fest. What are his thoughts on his new home?
Well, it's perfect for him because he got a chance to kind of not only meet the fans, his new fans were excited to be in because he said he's the only major addition to this team this offseason, but to meet his teammates, too, even especially the pitchers. He kind of talked to the guys about how they like to do things in spring training during the season. He's already been watching a lot of video of the Twins pitchers, so he's got a feel for, you know, their stuff and everything, but it's always kind of nice to kind of sit down and kind of get to know some of the pitchers before you get down to spring. But spring training is going to be huge for him to kind of work with all these guys. We've talked about it before, but great defensive catcher, famous for his pitch framing. He talked quite a bit about that as well at Twins Fest. I think even Twins fans at Twins Fest won't ask him about, you know, what pitch framing meant and all that. But, the stats on that are he's one of the best in baseball at that in terms of turning, you know, balls to strikes and, you know, that kind of thing to help his pitching staff, which will be key because Chris Suzuki, as much as he was, you know, a pretty solid game caller and planner, wasn't very good at that skill particularly. So I think the pitching staff is definitely excited about having him behind the plate. He hit, you know, the 1 year he was an all-star in 2013. Otherwise, he hasn't really offered as much offensively, but I think this year they're probably going to play him mostly against right-handers and then maybe kind of platoon him against lefties, whether it's going to be John Ryan Murphy or Chris Jimenez. Or even Mitch Garber, we'll see, as a backup. But Castro is definitely the starting guy. But I do think he's going to be mostly facing lefties this year.
And last thing, Rhett, you mentioned how some of these bats don't necessarily make sense for the Twins, but some of the bullpen arms available do. Anything new on that front or any names that might make particular sense for the Twins in the back end?
Yeah, there's definitely some names out there. Craig Breslow is probably the one most prominently linked to the Twins right now, as a former Twin as well. I think Boone Logan, a lefty they're looking at as well. There's some names out there. I mean, Joe Blanton had a good year with the Dodgers last year. He's a veteran they're looking at as well. So they're monitoring that market. And talking to, you know, Thad Levine at Twins Fest, he was saying they're definitely going to want to add at least one or two pitchers before the season starts. So I wouldn't, you know, we'll see if it happens, you know, how much they'll add. It could even be minor league deals, you know, you never know in terms of going forward. But 2 weeks from the day is when they report, so it's coming out pretty quick. But sometimes, you know, even relievers get signed once spring training even starts. So you never know. It's been a kind of a strange free agency. It seems like there's a lot of guys out there, like we've talked about too, even just offensively with Morneau and Napoli out there as well. And then on top of it, a lot of relievers and even starting pitchers too. There's some pretty solid Jason Hamill things out there. So there's some names out there that are, you know, pretty solid the Twins could look at. And, so I think more than anything, we might sign a reliever before the start of the season.
All right, there you have it, the latest from Rhett Bollinger. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Minnesota Twins edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.